During this past month, all during November, I've been talking about the inner meanings of Jesus' teaching with the idea that when we learn about the inner awareness that we become a more successful person. And of course, it's always the carrot that's out there to become a more successful person, I think, that gives us the incentive to want to study and learn. It reminds me of a conversation with one of the young men in the congregation here a month or so ago, which really prompted this kind of lesson. He said, well, first of all, I have to give you a picture of him, a mental, emotional picture. He's going through that wonderful stage that many young people go through, and I think they should. I went through it, you probably did. When they can't see why everything shouldn't be perfect. When they just can't understand why everyone can't be honest and why all politicians can't be and work for the good of the people and all bankers be more concerned with people than money and why all social programs just don't do exactly what they were brought into existence to do and why everyone doesn't act accordingly all the time to their highest motives. He just can't understand that. And he feels that he will be able to do this. Now, he's in that age where he has no responsibility or very little, and where he's really not interacting with the world around him. So it's kind of easy to, when you don't have responsibilities, when you're not connected up with a spouse, when you don't have families to be responsible for or employers, he just can't understand why that people do the things they shouldn't do. And after they do them, they wish they hadn't done them. He can't understand why they did them in the first place. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. So he comes to me and he says this, Reverend Stevens, why is it even in Christianity that there always has to be a reward? He said, why, I've studied religion, I've been to many churches, and he said, of course, my folks have come to this church since I was a little child. But he said, you're always talking about if you do this and this and this, you get this. And he said, why do you always have to throw out that temptation? He said, you're no different from any other minister. He said, some of them offer a heaven, but it's going to be after you die, or there's going to be glory and beauty and wonder. And he said, you just turn it around a little. You just say, well, the big prize is here now today if you want it, if you do this and this and this. He said, why do we always have to have a reward? Well, I said, it's a very basic thing. It isn't really a reward, because the way the universe is made, it's an action and reaction. It's a cause and effect kind of world. For instance, the Newton law that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction somewhere in the universe. I said, that's the way the universe works. Whenever I go down past the junior high school where I live, I see the boys and the girls too throwing the ball against the backstop, and it bounces back, and they throw it out again, and it bounces back, and they just have a big time with that. But little do they realize, hopefully they will learn, that everything in life is working according to that same principle. What you throw out is going to come back. Whether you want to believe it or not, it's the way the universe is made. Newton's law is scientific, but the same law works in the mental realm. Jesus said, whatever you sow, so shall you reap. It is action and reaction, action and reaction. Now, the thing to do is stop being a reactor and start being an actor. Stop reacting and start being a first cause. This is what we are trying to learn in life. We don't want to always just be reacting. We want to learn that the universe is run by law and that we can initiate. We can actually initiate action in this universe and be very sure of what the reaction is going to be. Now, the reason most of us don't learn to be first causes is because our mind is so full of what the other guy did and how the action came upon us. You know, I hate everybody, everybody's dishonest, everybody's terrible and awful and all of this. That doesn't do you any good. It doesn't solve any problem. I've never seen a problem solved yet by blaming it on somebody else. Not one. And if you've ever blamed a problem on somebody else and thereby solved it, you see me after church. We'll have a long talk. Because I'd just like to know what that problem was. You can't do it. So, don't feel bad. The only reason I know what I'm talking about is because I've reacted in the wrong way, and I've thrown a few balls against the, more than a few, against the backstop, thinking they wouldn't come back, and they did. And they come back with this, the same force that you throw them. And we all know that this is the way life works. So I told the young man, it's a wonderful stage you're going through, and I see your point, but you will develop other facets as well as this one. I have that. I sometimes think, why does everybody have to have a reward? But we develop more. So what I want to talk to you in the few moments we have here together is about the kingdom of heaven which is within us. And I've entitled it, and it's a nice title, A Treasure Just Waiting. And I've taken this from two of the remarks that Jesus made in the scripture, and they come one right after the other. There is a treasure. And the treasure is exactly what you probably know I'm going to say. But what I'm trying to do is reinforce it. You can have all the material things in the world. And this is great. But unless you know what you're really doing, it won't be so great. Now, Manly Hall wrote about the ego. And probably the ego is one of the most confused parts of our being. About surrendering the ego. He says, this is at once a surrender of the ego to the supremacy of the kingdom and the fulfillment of the ego in its establishment in a position of strength and importance as the representative of the totality of the personality. In other words, our egos do not represent all of us. There are times when our ego represents lust. There are times when our ego represents greed. There are times when our ego represents self-interest. I'm going to manipulate you to do what I want to do. That's when the ego begins to manipulate. And that's when the ego is bad. The ego is that central awareness that should integrate our whole personality. This is why I often say you have to have one set of rules in life. You can't have two or three. You can't have one when you're just with your friends. And you can't have another one when you're with your enemies. You can't have one set of rules that's the rules you apply to your family, and another set of rules you put forth to your employees. It has to be the same set of rules. Many of us have more than one set of rules. We have a set of rules for me when I'm dealing with myself, and I can have a set of rules when I'm dealing with other people. So the ego has to have one set of rules, and those rules have to be for all your personality. Like the man who is just a great guy and a wonderful fellow when he's not drinking. When he's drinking, he has another set of rules, and they come into play. And you say, George is the greatest guy in the world when he isn't drinking. When he's drinking, look out. He's mean, he's ornery, he's awful. He has two sets of rules. And you can see that the ego, the central awareness of his personality, has a very difficult time. Now, what we want to do is develop one set of rules, and we want to allow the ego to represent our total personality. If the ego is not representing the total personality, you know then that it's self-seeking, self-gratification. When the ego represents the central awareness, represents all of us, that's when we can commit ourselves. You can't commit yourself when the ego only represents a third of you. You can't commit yourself to anything when the ego only represents half of you. It has to represent all of you, the whole you. That's why if the ego doesn't represent all of you, you can never be committed. You'll say, oh, I'll do that. And 15 minutes later, you say, I'm tired of doing that. I want to do this over here. Because your mind and your emotions are not working together. It's very difficult to communicate with most of us because many of us never say what we think. We say what we feel. And we ourselves get mixed up on communication. We have a hard time communicating with ourselves. In meditation and quietness, this is where we bring ourselves together. This is where the emotions and the intellect harmonize, in quietness. Otherwise, we're thinking one thing and feeling another. So it isn't a matter of trying to extinguish or nullify or devalue the ego. The ego has to be. Because the ego, this is the expression, this pointedness in consciousness where we express the whole part of our being into any one particular direction or facet of our being. So it isn't a matter of trying to get rid of the ego. It's a matter of what? Of trying to let the ego represent the whole part of each one of us. A person not in possession of himself, and it's the ego that gives us possession of this outer self, a person who's not in possession of himself cannot turn himself over to the kingdom. The person who's not in possession of himself cannot give himself to another person in love. He can only give that part of himself that the ego really represents. Such a person who can give him whole, can commit himself, rather than will be proud, will be humble. So Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Now what is it to be blessed as? Blessed are the poor in spirit. It doesn't say I've now taken on the characteristics of some sort of doormat, come everybody and wipe their feet on me. No. The blessed are the poor in spirit, there's always that particular point in my consciousness and in time and space when I remember the first time I came into the presence of Albert Schweitzer. I got about 4 feet from him. I would have liked to have shaken his hand. There were too many people. But something happened when I saw that man many, many years ago in Los Angeles at a university, and I got that close. I was so awed and inspired by seeing him that I was, all of a sudden, I seemed to have learned just by looking at him when I felt of what he represented. It's the same way as if I were to see a manifestation of the Master. He wouldn't have to say anything to me because I would be so awed at seeing this thing and realizing the consequence of it that I would be open and receptive. Well, if we would be just in this state of mind when we come upon anything, any circumstance, any personality, be open and receptive. We don't hear most of the time what other people say. We don't see other people because we seldom look at them. You see, I say, I hate you. I don't hate you. I don't know you. I can hate my you. I say, I love you. Well, most of the time I should say, I need you. But say, for instance, I said I loved you, and I really tried. I'm only loving my you. That is, until my total personality stops painting pictures and images and lets me open enough. If my ego represents my whole being, then I can focus it upon you. And the interesting thing is, whatever I turn my attention to in a totality, that's what I become. And so we can become one with others. But only when we can turn our total, when we can commit ourselves to an individual, commit ourselves to a cause, commit ourselves to any particular thing, unless you can do it wholeheartedly, you're going to say, "Ho, ho, you fool me!" Because my you, of course, will change. You fool me, you deceive me, you dickens, you rascal. I don't like you anymore. And we go off to find my you somewhere else. And we are very disappointed, and we say life is cruel and awful and terrible, but all of this simply happened in our own consciousness. That's not the treasure we want. Jesus said, and he said this at this time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" So he called a little child to him and set the child in front of them. Then he said, "I tell you solemnly, unless you change and become like this little child, you will never enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so the one who makes himself as little as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Now why did Jesus say this? Because his disciples had brought an ego question to him. They came to him and they said, "Who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom when it comes?" Children were used a great deal by Jesus to make his points. And one thing about a little child, they don't have any mask. They're not hypocritical. You can say to a little child, "I love you. Do you love me?" And if they love you, they say yes. If they don't, they say no. "Don't you think I have a beautiful hat on? How do you like Mama's hat?" They may be polite enough not to answer, but you get the point. They may not like it. Children have no mask. We learn later on in life that it's best to say what others would like to hear us say, because we get promotions. They like us. We have esteem in their eyes. And so we learn to say what others want to hear most of the time. And this is neither good nor bad, as long as we understand what we're doing. But a child doesn't have this. And this is what Jesus said. You can't be self-seeking. You can't be just out for your own good. Or the kingdom, you'll never find this treasure, because you won't have the right attitude. You have to have an attitude like this little child sitting here. And the little child probably wasn't embarrassed. The little child wasn't ego-centered and sitting there feeling very uncomfortable in the midst of these grown men. The little child was just sitting there. And pretty soon got up and walked away and didn't realize that one of the great philosophical discourses of Jesus of all times used him or her as an example. Because the child was not aware of all of this going on. But the disciples were. They said, which one of us is going to be the greatest when the kingdom comes? You see, those disciples weren't committed. Really. I think later on they were, there's no doubt. But at that time they weren't. They were just trying to see what they could get out of it. They were good men, and they saw things that few of us have ever seen. But even then, they wanted to know, what am I going to get out of it? I'll tell you something about the ego. Whenever you live just on the self-awareness level, whenever you live just on the self-gratification level, one of the difficulties that we have is that we're not creative. The ego has no creativity in it at all. The imagination and the source of all which flows through us, and our imagination picks it up, the imagination is not the ego. And the ego will oftentimes keep itself isolated, or keep everything isolated, so it can control. So the creativity within us is stifled when we live on the I, me, and my level. There's no creativity. Whenever you get in a low spot in life, whenever nothing's happening, when nothing new is coming about, when you get disgusted with yourself, if you will examine yourself, you'll find that it's all my, me, and mine. If you want to get out of that difficulty, if you want to get out of that trough or darkness or whatever you want to call it, that corner, all you have to do is get yourself committed maybe to doing something nice for others, or expressing yourself, or looking around to see who you can help, or do some of the things that you should have done and you've been putting off, and you will find you will begin to start the creativeness flowing through you again. It will not work if you are living on just the self-gratification. And every time I say self-gratification, everybody says, oh, that means sex. No, it doesn't. It means the self-gratification on any level of your being. If it's just self, what am I going to get? And you can often tell when you're on the self-gratification level, because you will start feeling sorry for yourself. I didn't get my share. Well, of course you didn't get your share when you're living on that level. The creativity that we seek is a function of the inner imagination, not of the ego. And you'll find creative people, when they are in that creative mood, they are a part of the universe. They will not let that creativity come down to what I'm going to get out of it. That's a part of it. You know it at the time. But yet at the same time, there is a creative ability flowing through you that's giving itself to everything with no thought or very little thought of yourself. This is the kingdom, the treasure that is here for us right now, to be open and receptive enough to live on a level larger. First of all, to let our ego represent our whole being, but then to not live on that self-gratification level. Jesus said, do not store up treasures for yourselves on earth, where moths and woodworms destroy them, and thieves can break in and steal. But store up treasures for yourselves in heaven, where neither moth nor woodworms destroy them, and thieves cannot break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. A few lines more down, he says, set your hearts on this kingdom first, and on its righteousness, and all these other things shall be given to you as well. The Master knew human nature. He knew the kind of people. There's only a few different kinds, many mixtures and variations, but we all think that we're so different that we fool everyone else. But I doubt if that's really the case. He told a story about a man who was evidently a sharecropper, and he was plowing along in his field. And this man was probably thinking about how he would never get out of debt, and how he could just barely make a living and was eating from hand to mouth. And he probably thought to himself, how am I ever going to be anything? How am I going to get anything? I can't. But the interesting thing was, he just kept plowing along. He didn't go over and sit under a tree. He did what he could. He did what was necessary. He did the only thing that was available for him to do. But he was doing something, is what I've often got out of the story. Well, anyway, he was plowing along, thinking about how his wife might need a new dress, or his children would like to go to college, but they're stuck where he is in life. And as he was plowing along, the edge of his plow hit something. And as he looked down, it was shiny. And he realized it was some kind of a metal box. And he reached down for it, and he found it was a buried treasure. Now, this wasn't a difficult thing in those days to comprehend or to perceive, because there weren't any savings and loans or banks or safety deposit boxes. If you had anything valuable, you buried it, which was a good thing to do in the case of no bank or savings and loan. And so people were often turning up treasures. They would find them where somebody else hid them. And these treasures may have been recent or very old. So he found the treasure. The interesting thing is, he took the money and he went off and bought the field where he found it. Now, metaphysically, that means that in this man's drab life, in his own state of consciousness, in his own house, in his own realm of environment, was a treasure. The interesting thing is that he found it by accident. I have often equated this story to mean the people that never belonged to any religious institution or organization. They're not religious. They can believe in the man upstairs, and they do that, but they just go along in their life until sooner or later, it isn't by accident. It's they reach the place where they are capable of finding it. They reach the place in consciousness, in experience, in time, where they are ready to find it. And they find it. And that treasure is simply the awareness. It is the treasure of their great ability. That treasure that comes flowing through them gives them that which they have need of, if it's money or health or whatever it might be. The other story is of a rich merchant. A merchant who had a hobby. And his hobby was collecting pearls. Now, pearls, at that time, in that particular part of the world, there were many pearls because that was one of the crossroads of the trading routes. And pearls come in all colors and all sizes, and they're very beautiful, and I can see why someone would collect them. And this merchant collected these little pearls, and I can see when his great caravan came in with all of his servants, he let them handle things. And he went off in the marketplaces and the bazaars to see if he couldn't find some other pearls. Well, one day he came upon the pearl of great price, it tells in this ancient story. So he traded everything he had, all his other pearls, into the one. Now, this is the fellow, I've often felt, represents those that enter into a religious institution. Maybe one of the little pearls is singing in the choir. Maybe another little pearl is teaching Sunday school. You collect them. Another pearl is being an usher or working in the kitchen or scrubbing the floor, doing something. Those are the little pearls, and they're great. You can have a handful of them, and they're fun to have, and they're beautiful, and they belong just to you. But sooner or later, church is not just doing the outer things. There are many people that go to churches because that's their friends, that's their social life, that's their place where they get a little recognition, but that's not the reason. Sooner or later, you take all those little pearls and you trade them in because you find the real one. And the real one is, of course, as in Jesus' story and in mine, it is this inner awareness. It is the reality, the worthwhileness, the glory of you. And it is, you are glorious because you have the ability to let something flow through you. And this is how Jesus thought about it. He said, set your hearts on the kingdom first, and its righteousness, and that means right useness. And all these other things will be added unto you as well. I could tell you the story about a man I knew almost 15 years ago. His name, we'll say, is Russell. He lived in the North County. Russell invented, with a friend of his, a new kind of skin to put on a golf ball. And it made the ball last longer. It made it go further. It did all kinds of things. It was a fantastic thing. And so he started going all over the country promoting this. And he did a very good job in promoting it. And so much so that he became a millionaire. And I talked to Russell a few times. He was very generous and always has been generous with his congregation. And one time we talked and he said, "You know, Reverend Stevens, even though I'm away 3 or 4 days a week," he said, "and sometimes I stay in the crummiest hotels, and whenever I sit down in a meal that isn't any good," he said, "I always think about, well, at least my wife and my children have better food because they have a cook. And it's good food." He told me of the money he poured in his big home and his swimming pool and his tennis courts and his stables and all of this. He just poured money into that. But he said, "Whenever I'm away and I get to feeling down," he said, "I think about my family and I think about how well off they are." And he said, "Boy, then I go, because," he said, "it makes me feel good." Well, it was a few years ago that Russell called me up and he said he was crying. He said, "I must talk to you." And he'd always done. He said, "Let's have lunch." Well, we did. And in the middle of lunch, he started to cry. Now, just before he started to cry, and to see a man cry, it isn't bad, but it disturbs you, especially a man that you think a great deal of. Well, the first thing he said after we'd ordered, he said, he mentioned his wife's name, "She's left me. She got tired of me. She got tired of the way of life that I was living. She got tired of me and my goals and my attitudes and my way of doing things." And he said, "She's gone, my house, everything, children, the whole deal." He said, "I just feel like there's nothing left." He said, "I really feel like I could kill myself." He's a very intelligent man. There was not a threat in his voice at all. He was just giving me the fact. Well, he started to cry after he said that, and we got out of the restaurant. We went out and set in the car. And again he said, "I just feel like I could kill myself. There isn't anything left." He said, "Go ahead, tell me what you want to." He said, I'll listen. But he said, "I tell you honestly, there's not much left." Well, I said, "Why don't we have a prayer?" He bowed his head like he thought I knew he'd say that. And I often say that when I can't think of anything else to say, I'll admit. And I said, in the beginning, I said, "Go ahead and die, Russell." I had my eyes closed, so I don't know what his reaction was. But I said, "Don't die some other time or in some other place, but die now. Let that which is within you, which didn't work, die. Let that which is within you that you don't have need of anymore, die. But let that which is within you that's learned, let that which is within you that you didn't pay any attention to before, let that which is within you that you've played like didn't exist and was the unlived part of your life, let that begin to live." Well, he opened his eyes right after that and he said, "I'll do that. That makes sense. But how do you do it? But I can do it. I understand what you're saying, because there's a lot of life in me that's unlived. There's a lot of things that I wouldn't let happen. I was too busy concentrating on one thing." He had let his ego represent only a part of himself. He had not allowed his whole being to be. I said, "What would you like to do?" He said, "Well, if I could do anything, I'd like to play the guitar and sing." I said, "Why don't you do that?" I said, "What was another thing you'd like to do?" He said, "I'd like to take a year off and just buy a little camper and breeze around the country." I said, "Okay. What else would you like to do?" He said, "I'd like to find a companion, a wife, and be happy." He said, "I'd like to be able to invite my children over and be their father." I said, "All right, you have lots to live for. Go do that." Well, he didn't buy a guitar, he bought a little organ. He didn't buy a camper, but he did take a lot of drives. He changed his business. He still is a prosperous man. And he's fine, but he died. But he lives. but he lives more wholly. He lives more fully. He lives where he can respond his whole being to the woman he's married to now. He responds with his whole being to the children that are his now that he sees them. He doesn't think about what he's given them. He thinks about his relationship to them. And he's a very happy man. And you couldn't get him to leave the house to go anywhere except to his work and to come right back. If then they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go there. Look, he is in some hiding place, do not believe it. Because the coming of the Son of Man will be like lightning striking in the east and flashing far into the west. In other words, it can come at any time. This awareness, it is like lightning because it is illuminating. All of a sudden you think, gee whiz, I'm not that kind of person that I've always thought. What am I going according to these laws and dogmas that I've built up or accepted that other people have given me? I am an identity. I do not have to react to everything. I do not have to get up in the morning and say, I wonder how everybody else is going to be, and then I'll know how I am. I can get up in the morning and say everything is beautiful and wonderful. It doesn't matter what else is going on. I can project this with my whole self. I don't have to manipulate other people to do what I want them to do. If I do what I think is best, the whole world will respond. And my best will go forth in all directions. This is what the real treasure is. The treasure is simply to be and to become. You can't mark this down and say, here's a chart and it will work. But I can tell you, if you go forth and do the best you can, it will be astounding what will happen. Now, what have I told you? One, let your ego represent all of you. And you can do this when you have the same set of rules for you that you have for everyone else. Jesus said, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. That's the same set of rules. And then as you go forth into life, you'll find out that everything you put out will come back. And that you don't have to be a reactor, you can be a first cause. You can realize that when you live on this egotistical level of just self-gratification or getting what you want, there's no creativity. You can realize that as you open yourself, that the creative power will begin to flow through you. And of course, this is happiness and joy eternal. Let us be reminded. It's so easy to think that it's somewhere else. But Jesus said again, if then they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go there. Look, he is in some hiding place, do not believe them. Because the coming of the Son of Man, the coming of the realization of your true self, will be like lightning striking across the east and flashing itself far into the west. It is that moment of inspiration when you are not your self-image, when you are not your ego, when you are not the product of other people, when you are not the mold of the society you live in, when somehow you take one step back and you see that you are an identity and that your consciousness is God. And that as you think and dream, that consciousness becomes the world we live in. So there is a treasure, and it's ours today. Now let us be still and give thanks that we have ears to hear and hearts to understand. And the treasure is overwhelming. This we pray in the presence of Jesus Christ. Amen.